And welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 105. Your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
And me, Ravi Abbott.
And welcome to the show, where every week we talk about classic systems that you might have grown up with back in the day, you know, whether it was a Mega Drive or Super Nintendo, or used to run home and load up games on your Commodore 64 cassette deck.
Or your Speccy, there was loads of them, weren't there?
So many systems to cover. And actually, speaking of which, on this week's show, we're kind of talking about a system that doesn't really get a lot of love from retro gamers this side of the pond.
No, because we've talked to a lot of American developers, and a lot of American developers have done Apple II stuff, they've done Macintosh stuff. We really didn't have anybody doing that in the UK. I don't remember seeing many Macs around, do you?
I think the first Mac I saw, it was summer holidays when I was about 7 years old. And my auntie owned like a print shop in Shrewsbury. Mm. And I went in there and she had like these, you know, little computers that were all like all in ones and like a mouse. I was like, and I remember drawing my name in like the paint program and printing
like
it out.
White and stylish.
But I had like a Commodore at home and that was colour graphics and the Mac was black and white. So yeah. In some ways it seemed a bit less advanced, but the mouse and stuff was pretty cool. But like you said, they had such a big scene in America. And not so much over here in the UK, which is why I guess this week was actually quite unique.
Yeah, little did we know there was a little Mac scene going on the Isle of Wight in the UK. And this is Patrick Buckland, who is a co-founder of Stainless Games, and he's done some great titles for the Mac. Crystal Quest was one, and, you know, he's also done, Carmageddon.
Massive series, obviously. And even going back to, like, you know, the Apple II, he did some early games on there when he's about, you know, 17 years old. One of them was called Liberator. That is kind of a bit of an infamous story now, because he worked with EMI, who I didn't even realise did games.
No, yeah, that's really odd that they had a division, but it was so early on, wasn't it?
Yeah. But they actually burnt the entire stash of one of his games before it even went on sale. So he's got some really interesting stories to tell. I think you're going to really enjoy this one. Patrick Buckland is going to be our special guest on the Retro Hour podcast in around 25 minutes from now. And speaking of special guests, we've got quite a few of them coming up, haven't we? At a rather big event happening in Blackpool next month.
Oh yeah, Play Blackpool, the place of cheap pints and good games.
Now, for people that may not have been to Play Expo before, what's kind of the draw for you?
The draw for me is kind of the stores, actually. Like, I would say, the fabulous talks by the Retro Hour podcast.
Obviously, that's number one. Yeah, yeah.
But the stores as well, because there's so much good stuff there. Like, I'm probably going to spend a lot of money. Like, every time I go to these events, it's really bad because I get a big dent in my pocket because I'm going around going, oh, look at that rare piece. Or some of the stuff that's made by people. So they have, like, this bead art stuff where they're making pixel versions and stuff, and they've got... They were selling cells from cartoons last time, and you could get individual cells from cartoons and like frame them and stuff. And it's weapons. There's absolutely everything there.
But yeah, I mean, I love the trading areas. And I think last year, you know, I picked up a Sega 32X and I got... We both got these, didn't we? These little cases for the Raspberry Pi.
Yeah. They're these kind of like mini Pi cases, and they've done them in all the different themes. I think you can get like a little ST one and an Amiga one.
Commodore 64 one, I think I got.
I got a VIC-20 one as well.
Well, they're great, and obviously lots of games as well. I mean, there's always a big console retailers are there. And often the prices you find are a lot better than eBay too.
Yeah, and like I would say the arcades, and a lot of people say the arcades, but we never get a chance because... Every time we go to the arcades, it's always at the peak time. Yeah. So there's like queues of 20 to 15 people.
But I also love, I mean, there is always at Play a nice big area full of like classic consoles and computers as well.
Yeah.
You know, you're playing on Vectrex and stuff like that.
Oh, totally. But also, now that we've gone for quite a few years, it's just seeing everyone.
Yeah.
You know, bumping into the regular faces, seeing, you know, Sean Holly with all the arcades and seeing all the other guys around there. It's just fantastic.
Well, we're going to be doing, obviously, the talks area again, and we're actually going to have a guy who's going to be on our show in the next week or two, Steve Hammond from DMA Design. He's actually coming on the podcast.
We are not worthy. Oh my God. Yeah.
We're talking games like, obviously, Lemmings, Hired Guns.
Lemmings 2.
Shadow of the Beast.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, actually, Steve is going to be our guest on the show in the next week or two, but then we're going to be doing a live panel with him and maybe a few other members from that kind of era as well.
Yeah, we've got some exciting Spectrum people that may be coming as well.
Well, the Oliver Twins are going to be there too. Obviously, they're doing a game for the Spectrum, a new Dizzy game for the Spectrum next that I've heard might be getting, you know, might have a little chance to play that if you're coming down. We're also going to have our massive YouTuber panel as well. Now, these are all people that we've had on the Retro Hour podcast before. Guru Larry, Kim Justice, Slopes Game Room, who was on last week.
Yeah.
Daniel, he's going to be there. Nostalgia Nerd, Peter Lee. Really, you know, amazing YouTube channels. We kind of cherry-picked our favourite YouTubers from the UK to come along to this, didn't we?
I think they're the best, yeah. in our opinion. Yeah.
And when we've had them all on the show, I mean, they're all such interesting people to talk to. And I'm sure if you're into retro gaming like we are, you'll probably watch our channels anyway. So it's a chance to come down, enjoy a panel, see them live, get to meet them, buy them a drink at the bar.
I think so. I've spent about a week watching Slopes' Kickstarter videos recently.
You got hooked.
Got hooked, yeah, I got the bug.
So tickets are on sale now. It happens next month on the 10th and 11th of February. Over the weekend, Saturday and Sunday, both days. We'll be there for the entire weekend. And actually, if you'd like to come along and be our very special guests, we do have a little competition running on our website right now. Now, we decided to keep it easy, didn't we? No question.
No, just go to theretrohour.com/win-play-expo-blackpool-tickets. You'll probably be able to find it on the front page.
Yeah, it's got a few hyphens in there, I think. Yeah. The direct URL. That's very old school, Ravi, reading out the...
URL slug, yeah.
HTTP, colon. Yeah. But yeah, we have got a little competition running on there. It's open for a couple of weeks. All you got to do is fill in your details on the form there. We'll pick out a couple of people at random and you'll win free weekend passes to come along, you and a mate, and enjoy the entire weekend in Blackpool. And there's loads going on as well. I mean, after the show, we always end up going out, don't we? Nice restaurant, few drinks.
Restaurant. That's the thing. I think this year as well, because it's in the middle of winter, the hotel's just going to be all of us retro people.
Yeah.
So let's party at the hotel. Let's take over the bar.
I heard there's room for like £25 at the venue. Yeah, it's like, you know what I mean? You can get a really good price, actually, with breakfast included. And then we always end up going to that little cafe, don't we, for breakfast next day?
Yeah, we've got a little local greasy spoon.
I did the nicest omelette, though. Yeah, I think it was about £3, I think, and a coffee. So, yeah, if you want to come along, do check out that competition on the front page of our website, theretrohour.com. While you're on our website as well, if you'd like to give a little something back, you know, we always do appreciate this. You know, we put the show out week in, week out for over 2 years now.
Yeah.
We don't ask for anything for it. If you want to just listen, you know, it's completely fine by us. If, though, you'd like to support the show, I mean, it is always nice if we don't have to pay for the entire thing out of our own pockets. Let's just go to events and stuff. Let's just keep doing the show, pay for all our hosting, all our subscription services we've got to do every couple of months. So all you got to do is nip onto our website, theretrohour.com. We have a couple of donation buttons on there that you can find. Any amount, completely up to you, either via PayPal or cryptocurrency, if you're into that market as well. We accept all of them, I think, now.
We accept tokens on the Ethereum network and Bitcoin and other stuff, yeah.
So you can find all those links on the front page of theretrohour.com. This week, thank you so much for your donations. Krista Holston.
Tim Dellman.
Lawrence Fort.
And Joe Locker,
who all made donations through our website. You can do the same and find your place in the Hall of Fame in a future episode of the Retro Hour podcast. Head on to our website, theretrohour.com. Now, plenty of news doing the rounds this week. Should we start with some Apple news, actually?
Yeah, let's get into it. I love this old kind of Apple stuff, you know. Oh, and this is about the Lisa.
Now, the Apple Lisa, that was kind of the first, was Apple's first machine with a GUI.
It was, yeah. And then there's famous scenes where Steve Jobs goes, he stole it from me, when he sees the first Windows machine.
Yeah, Bill Gates has ripped him off. But I mean, to be fair, Steve Jobs did steal it from Xerox PARC.
Oh, yeah.
So what goes around comes around. But obviously, if you've seen the movie Pirates of Silicon Valley, that scene's in, isn't it? Which is a top movie. But the Lisa, I mean, technically the Lisa was a commercial failure because it cost $10,000 in 1983. Today, that'd be $24,000.
Yeah, and they say Macs are expensive now.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, you buy like a $2,000 MacBook Pro now. It's pennies compared to what it was back then. But obviously, this machine is kind of legendary because it was the first Apple machine with a graphical user interface. It was, you know, based on the Xerox PARC technology that they saw, and it kind of did set the future prototype for what all GUIs will become. And still are today, you know, many of the systems that were introduced there. Now, apparently, Lisa stood for Local Integrated System Architecture. But obviously, if you watch our film, you know it was named after his daughter, wasn't it? That he denied he ever had at the time. So it's a really cool system. I mean, I've never actually seen one in person.
I've never seen one in person. I know somebody with one, but he's probably got it under lock and key.
That Marvin.
Yeah.
Well, they only sell 10,000 units of them. And it cost them $150 million to develop this system. And apparently, this is one of the reasons that Steve Jobs actually left Apple, because the new CEO came in, John Sculley from Pepsi, and basically Jobs wanted to keep the Lisa project going, but it wasn't making money, so they had that big fallout and he left.
Yeah, it was like a kind of passion project, wasn't it, for Steve? Yeah.
And
John Sculley was like, this is realistic. And then the Mac came out, and yeah.
Yeah, Jobs went off in a huff and started Next, you know, shortly after that. So, legendary machine. And what's quite interesting is, even though it's been 35 years now, Apple have decided they're going to release the source code with the Computer History Museum. They're going to release the Apple Lisa OS for free as kind of an open source project.
Oh, cool. That's really cool, because that's, yeah, going back to the Xerox PARC stuff, and you could probably do a side-by-side comparison, couldn't you?
Well, that's it. Even for someone who, you maybe might not be a developer or anything like that, which I'm not, you know, but I can look through code and, you know, especially if it's well-commented, you can see what's going on. You've got, you know, more programming experience than I have. But I think looking back at this early source code for the first commercial graphical user interface, there's got to be some really interesting stuff in there.
Oh, totally, yeah. If you're a real code monkey, you can get in there and do some crazy stuff, I can imagine.
Yeah, or even maybe, you know, people could develop new Lisa stuff using this source code. So, might be interesting. And there is actually
official... Or even update the OS. You know?
Yeah, brand new version that you can run on, like, your Touch Bar MacBook Pro, yeah. Well, this was announced as actually a list called the Lisa List, which is like for Apple Lisa enthusiasts. Like a mailing list, they announced it on there, and that's going to be coming out very soon by the looks of it. So we'll put a link to that in this week's show notes at theretrohour.com. Slightly nerdy, but very cool, I think.
Oh, very cool, yeah.
Obviously, it was CES, wasn't it, last week?
Well, this is interesting, because I've not really heard many people at CES talk about retro things, but this year seems to be a big change. Now, I'm a big listener to Leo Laporte's podcast, the tech guy. Yeah. And he turned around and he said, CES, they had this Game Boy thing. You know, it was just all old stuff. And it's like, actually, Leo, that's now popular.
The one we were talking about last week.
Yeah, the Hyperkin, yeah, that we were talking about. Well, there's a lot of stuff that's come out at CES.
But I know Retro Gamer Magazine did a little roundup, actually, of quite, you know, a lot of the stuff that was announced then. It's quite a lot.
Because retro's been dominating the kind of news in it. Retro and stupid robots falling over everywhere.
Oh, God, I saw it was LG that did that demo where it ignored him.
Yeah. That was good.
Oh, that was so cringe.
Cringeworthy stuff, if you want to look that up. But Retrobit, another company, and we've covered them before. Remember we talked about the Retrobit top loaders?
Oh, the console
and,
they did.
And the older consoles, yeah. They've officially gone together with Sega now.
Right.
So they're officially making Sega merchandise, but they're also announcing their own little Game Boy as well, which is called the Go Retro Portable.
Another Game Boy.
Another Game Boy to fight the hype again.
Well, they're making accessories for the Dreamcast and the Saturn as well.
We'll get onto that first. This Game Boy includes LCD screen, scratch resistant, all of that, rechargeable lithium batteries. Mm-hmm. But guess how much it is, mate?
What, for this Game Boy?
Yeah.
Pricey?
$34.99.
Oh, wow. Okay.
That's dollars as well.
Yeah. Probably $34.99 quid then.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah. So
that's not too shabby.
That's not bad at all, is it, for your machine that you can kind of play all your old school stuff in? And it's not, it doesn't use carts. It uses built-in games, but they're 300 and they're officially licensed. You see, this is
and you know someone's going to hack it the minute it comes out.
Oh yeah,
you know there'll be every game on there before the end of the month.
Oh, completely. But now the other part of the Sega deal. Here we go. So that's the licensed games on their thing to fight Hyperkin.
Yep.
Now they're releasing Sega accessories.
So these are for the original systems.
Yeah. Saturn controllers at the moment. Genesis controllers. All Bluetooth that work with the original system.
Wow.
Yeah. And they've got little adapters there. They've got Dreamcast controllers. They've got even got the rare Dreamcast RGB adapters, so you can get true RGB signals out of the back of the Dreamcast.
Because the Dreamcast is quite well connected in terms of video, isn't it? It can do quite a lot of different...
Oh, yeah, it's 480i it can go up to, so... All these rare cables, you know, you might get your Dreamcast broadband adapter being remade.
What is good, I mean, I'm looking at some of the pictures here, and they've got the original, like, Sega Saturn branding on the boxes.
And that's one of my favourite controllers, that is the Sega Saturn. It's so comfortable, honestly.
Yeah, I like the... I've got the 3D controller for the Saturn. Have you seen that on the round one? That's good for, like, playing the FPSs and stuff like that. But just for the pure, like, you know... arcade games, yeah, the original pad's really good. But yeah, like you said, they've got a Genesis one as well, which is a Bluetooth arcade pad, and it actually does look really comfy.
Yeah, and you just plug that into your original Genesis, the Bluetooth receiver, and you can play it. It's like, what?
I love the fact that Sega have actually thought, you know, yeah, we'll give them the branding to do that. The Dreamcast one, it looks like it could have been a product that was released in like 1999. You got the swirl on there. Even kind of the artwork and stuff looks like the original Dreamcast box.
Yeah, and that's it. And it's for Sega Saturn and it's for this system. But I'm reading the small print. I've zoomed in on one of them.
Yeah.
And it says here on the Bluetooth arcade, it's for PC, Mac and...
Oh, wow, okay.
Android devices compatible with games from Sega Mega Drive. So I think maybe the Bluetooth one is just a PC thing because they might not be able to get that running. But the other stuff is all for the systems.
Oh, well, it's good for emulation, I guess, isn't it? You know, maybe use that. So, yeah, with a built-in blast processing as well, no doubt.
Uh-huh. Well, we're just waiting for the console, aren't we, guys?
So we'll put that in this week's show notes if you want to find out more. It's good that you get, you know, new stuff like that because there's one thing, I don't mind buying secondhand systems. Mm. And if you're into, like, the retro market, you've got no choice, really, most of the time, if you want to get the originals. What I don't like is, though, having a controller that someone else is, like, had their hands on for like 20, 30 years.
Or paying 90 quid for a cable just to do something, or a mouse or something weird like that, you know, that's just because there's a limited supply. It's so expensive.
When I got a couple of joysticks off eBay, and the first thing I do is, you know, you get a wet wipe and you wipe them all down, and they're always black afterwards, aren't they?
Dead skin on there.
And you've got to go through all, like, you know, the little cracks in the casing, get all the dirt out of those.
Old toothbrush is good.
Well, you know, some of them, you've got the little suction cups on the bottom.
Yeah.
And I remember kids, you know, you'd lick them and put them down the table.
Suck it.
Like,
oh. Stick it on there, yeah.
30 years of old encrusted spit on them. So, yeah, apologies if you're listening while you're eating. So, yeah, get some new stuff out. New controllers. They're always appreciated.
Antibacterial wipes.
She includes them in the box for future buyers, yeah. Do you remember a game called 1942?
Oh, of course. It's a classic game, 1942 is.
Amazing shoot-em-up game. I always remember going to the seaside. And actually, you know, if you go to... We were talking about Play Expo before. I often see a few cabinets there. There's two. It was Capcom brought it out, didn't they?
Yeah.
1942 and 1943, I remember. Really cool shoot-em-up game. But now, I thought this was really cool. AmiTen, who are a Tenerife-based Amiga YouTube channel, but they also do, like, software and stuff like that as well. They've actually done a remake for the Amiga in Amos.
Oh, cool. Amos, yes. I love Amos. It was an old visual programming
language. It was basic, wasn't it? Yeah,
it was basic, but it was done in a visual script so that people could actually understand it and not have to get into the raw code themselves. It's done by Francois Lynette, who's a good friend of ours, actually.
Yeah, well, we worked with him at Friend Software today. Yeah. And we had him on the show, actually, didn't we, not long ago, to find out a bit more about Amos and Stoss. But, I mean, it's always been, you know, not only a game that I love, but also, like I said, a language that was very accessible to kids. So I did a bit of programming on, like, the Commodore 8-bit machines. Yeah. But then when I got Amos, it was always on, like, magazine cover discs that you get them, wasn't it? But
nearly every PD game was made with either Blitz Basic or Amos, wasn't it?
But the thing is, I mean, a lot of people back in the day did used to look down a bit on Amos, saying it's not that powerful. Mm. But if you look at this video, I actually think this looks like a really good shoot-em-up.
No, this looks like quite a good Amiga game, to be honest, you know, and it doesn't compare to the greatest Amiga one, which is, oh, God, what is
Banshee,
it?
You
Banshee,
mean.
Banshee, yeah, that is just insanely good. But, this is a bloody good effort from Amos, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's got, like, you know, the scrolling looks really good. The sprites are quite small in it. But actually what's really cool is, obviously, AmiTen, he does, like, a YouTube channel, doesn't he? But he's also done, like, a little tutorial on how he made it as well, showing, like, if you want to see how he coded
that's
the game.
Good.
So,
and, you know, I remember Biplanes. That was the best little PD Amos game that was.
I still play that game with my brother when he comes over. Yeah, it's awesome.
Battle on Biplanes.
They're trying to get it fly up in the air and you go backwards.
Yeah.
So if you want to download that, there's actually an ADF that you can download for free. I'll put that in this week's show notes. And just while we're on the subject of, like, remakes of classic games, a game that I used to love, because I'd always see it at the Seaside Arcades, was a game called Phoenix.
Oh, wow. Okay, I'm just looking at screenshots of this, and it does bring back memories of those little kind of ones that would spiral down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you'd get, I mean, it was quite a simplistic game.
It looks a bit like Space Invaders.
Well, it was early, actually, looking at it. I didn't realise it came out this early. 1980, that game was released. I mean, I probably played it in about 89, 90, you know, quite late.
Yeah.
I think, actually, I was on holiday with my family in Spain. We went on holiday, and there was an arcade machine in the lobby of the hotel, and it was Phoenix.
Ah.
And I'd just go in there, my brother, and we're like, we just play it all night, because it was the only thing to do while my parents were, like, you know, sitting in a restaurant or whatever.
Yeah.
But, like, it was quite an easy game to complete as well. There's only about four or five stages on it. So you get the first level where you get these, like, aliens come down, second one that drops some bombs and stuff on you. Then you get these birds that fly out, and they come out as eggs. then you've got to shoot them and break them up. Final level on it, you get this kind of like
those
weird
birds
alien.
Are massive as well.
Yeah, the arcade version was huge. But then you get like, yeah, the end level is rock hard, where you get this like alien in the mothership and you've got to kind of get your bullets through and break into him and kill him.
It's kind of a bit like Breakout, that last bit where you've got to smash through the ship.
But with loads of bullets coming down at the same time. It's quite a challenging game, but it was always one of my favourite shoot 'em up games, and not really a game that gets a lot of love these days. Everyone talks about, like, you know, R-Type and Space Invaders and all those, but and Galaga. But Phoenix was actually really good. And I'm quite pleased to see there's actually been a new updated version of it released that you can download and play on Windows.
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah, it's this website you can download it from called lurtaste.itch. They've released it for free. I think he did like an announcement about this before Christmas, then released it a week later. But I always think it's cool when someone actually takes it upon themselves, because by the looks of it, it's just one guy that's done it. But obviously, it was a labour of love from somebody who loved Phoenix and thought, oh, I want to give more people a chance to play.
Yeah, there you go. You know, you've seen that and you've just got your little nostalgia hit from that. And then hopefully a lot of other people will remember Phoenix and make his efforts worth it.
Yeah, and if you haven't seen it before or played it, highly recommend it. And if you want to download that, play it on your modern PC at work. I'll put that in this week's show notes at theretrohour.com. I thought this is quite an interesting study that's been done by Curry's PC World, of all people. Now, this is an article on their Funstock Retro, and it essentially is talking about how retro games have showed what good staying power they've got. Now, they're looking at kind of the top games that have been talked about on social media. It's more of an analysis of like British gamers and what their interests and like kind of hobbies and habits are, and what games they buy and which games they talk about the most.
Okay.
And it turns out these are the top 10 games that have been talked about the most on social media in, say, I think it's about the last 4 years of the study of this. You've got Grand Theft Auto in there, FIFA, Call of Duty, right? The modern stuff, Minecraft is in there, Overwatch. But then it's stuff like Mario Kart, Pac-Man, Tekken, stuff like that in there.
Oh, Tekken, yes.
And they reckon, you know, out of all those games, Mario Kart and Pac-Man actually like are some of the biggest talked about games on social media. Pac-Man in particular rules Twitter.
That's the thing, you know, they're icons, aren't they? And they're going to stay in people's memory forever, because Pac-Man was just such a big thing, so bigger than all of this Call of Duty and all that kind of stuff is.
What is interesting, though, is apparently looking at gamers, weirdly, because Pac-Man was kind of designed with a female demographic in mind, but if you look at social media, apparently it's a 70-30 split in favour of males talking about Pac-Man. So it's actually the blokes that really love Pac-Man. Girls are playing like different games these days, it reckons.
Okay.
And in terms of younger players, the game, obviously Minecraft is like number one in that demographic, but Mario Kart is actually one of the most popular. They talk about, like, you know, kind of pre-teen gamers.
Yeah, because I guess Mario Kart and stuff's going to get reference to the old one and the new one, and with a lot of these remakes, you know, a lot of the titles come in, but I haven't heard of a Pac-Man remake, have you? So,
well, Pac-Man gets remade every other week, though, doesn't it?
Pac-Man's like eternal, isn't it?
Yeah, it always comes out on every platform. I mean, there is like an old Namco gaming set that you can get from the Nintendo Switch, and Pac-Man's on there, obviously, like two different versions of it. What I think it is, though, I think especially with the younger end of the market, it's probably parents, like, you know, dads and their sons or daughters playing together.
Yeah, it's always there. And, you know, you don't see the same thing with kind of Worms or Lemmings or any of that kind of stuff. But this adds to companies wanting to get involved with retro, more people listening to our podcast, all this kind of stuff. It's great.
Well, it shows the staying power, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Now, before we get into our interview with Patrick Buckland, you're a fan of GoldenEye 007?
I loved GoldenEye. I used to go around my friend's Callum's house and killing with proximity mines after work every day. Well, after school.
Well, we were playing it at Joe's house, weren't we, on his Christmas party?
Oh, God, disastrous. Oh. You don't want to watch that.
Always get thrashed at GoldenEye. Even though the game came out, can you believe, over 20 years ago? 21 years ago that game came out now. Yeah. 1997. It's still got such a dedicated following, that game. Even in terms of, now that you can get flashcards and that kind of thing, people have done quite a lot of mods for it. And there is actually a website called GoldenEye Vault, which is a fan site for it. Mm-hmm. They've actually got a big mod section on there. Now, there's a guy called Super Mario Bros. One Fan. He's actually gone through the game, changed the graphics, and replaced the original Bond character with Mario and Luigi.
I'm just watching the video now. He's just going around shooting Koopa Troop. Like, this is great. And I remember Big Head Mode.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
I do, yeah.
This is like big character mode on every aspect. It's not just their head. Their arms are giant. And
Even look at the hand, it's a white glove, isn't it? Like Mario's white glove. So I think that is genius, though. It's hilarious. If you want to just watch the video, I'd highly recommend that.
Mario and Luigi as well. You can go around with Luigi.
They all look sad on the faces, though. Look how sad Luigi looks with a gun in his head.
Oh, God, they've got Donkey Kong. And it says it actually works on actual hardware as well.
Yeah, if you've got a flash card, yeah. You can play them there, which is pretty amazing. I would feel really bad, though, shooting like Yoshi in the head.
I don't know. It's really good fun. If you're an anti-Nintendo guy, it could be the highlight of your week.
You sicko. So if you want to check that out, I'll put that in this week's show notes as well. Right, thank you so much for checking out episode number 105 of the Retro Hour podcast. We'll be out again next Friday from all of your favourite download sites, your favourite podcast clients, YouTube, Stitcher, SoundCloud, iTunes, wherever you listen. Please do keep your ratings coming in as well. That always really, really helps. And you can check out the competition to win some free tickets for Play Expo Blackpool on our website, theretrohour.com.
Yeah, we've got some great guests coming up for you. But now we have Patrick Buckland, chairman and co-founder of Stainless Games.
And we'll see you next week.
Ciao.
You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it's time to welcome this week's very special guest. Welcome to the show, Patrick Buckland.
Thank you, yes. I appreciate being asked on.
Now, we're going to talk to you about, you know, legendary games like Carmageddon in just a bit. We can't wait to get those stories. But this is something that we always like to start our interviews with, just to get, you know, a little bit of background. If we go right back to the beginning, where did it all start for you with computers then? What was, like, your first experience or your earliest memory?
First experience is using a Commodore PET at school, getting used to that, and then a RML tree, as you said, rack mount at school. Then my granny bought me an Apple II, so that I was interested in programming. So when I was 15, she bought me an Apple II, a cassette drive. That would have been 1978, 79, something like that. So that's how I started, really, just programming in my bedroom on the Apple II.
It must have been quite a pricey machine back then.
It was, yeah. So I was complaining when she got me. I think if I go perfectly well, she got me it so that I could be the flashiest boy at school. So that suited me fine. So I got my computer.
So
it took me 2 years to persuade her to buy me a disk drive, though.
Well, what kind of thing were you doing on the Apple II then at home?
First of all, just learning stuff. Yeah, just messing around, modifying the games that they produced. Got to know the local computer shop up here. They gave me a little bit of contract work, even back when I was like 16, 17, just doing some... the guy's brother was a chemist, so I did a label printing program. That's my first paying work, which I paid a printer, so I got a printer for that. But quite early, I started writing games. My very first game was Liberator, which is a game for the Apple II, which I submitted to an advert, I think it was in the Radio Times, for Thorium I Video Programs Limited, so we're called, quaintly, based in Soho. That's Thorium I being the gigantic conglomerate at the time, they're huge, they've disappeared now. They were trying to get into the video game industry. I sent them off this game that I wrote over the Christmas holiday while at school, and they accepted it. So that was my first published game.
Well, you mentioned that there was a small computer shop there as well. What was the kind of scene like on the Isle of Wight then?
There really wasn't one at all. The fact that we had a computer shop at all was very unusual. That was a couple of guys who were based in Cowes, who were just sailing. So they were supplying some of the sort of high-end clients and stuff. They were all Apple-based at the time. They went to PC afterwards. But even that was quite unusual. The local technical college here had a lecturer and a PET at home. I used to go, before I had my own computer, my mother knew him, so I used to go occasionally around to his house and play around with the Commodore PET, just for a few hours in his home. But there was nothing else. There was no scene as such at all. It's too early for that. We were making our own. And I'm often jealous when I hear about what was happening with Wozniak and Jobs in Silicon Valley, and that great scene that was going on there at the same time. Would have been fantastic to have been, living somewhere that had that, but Britain was a bit behind.
Got to make the most of what you've got, though.
Yeah, exactly. You make your own scene.
Well, I mean, what were the sales like of Liberator? And, were you kind of surprised at how many people were buying the game at first?
Well, that's quite an infamous story now, that. So it was a very good game. Everyone loved it. Everyone was at uni was playing it. And after my first term at uni, I contacted them and said, well, how's it going? And, where's my royalty check? And they said, oh, no, we burned them all. I'm sorry. So, yeah, we had a cease and desist letter from Atari, because Liberator, the name was a reverse missile command game, a very obscure coin-op by Atari. They did a game called Liberator, where you were firing missiles down onto the planet rather than the other way. Never heard of it. Thought you might never do a trademark search. So Atari sent them a letter, just before the game actually went on sale. And so they manufactured it, though. So they just burned them all. Never told me. Never said, hey, suppose you give us another build because you're a different game. So that was my first exposure to the video games industry. Which is, I took legal advice, and the local lawyer says, you're 17, and it's you versus Thorium Eye. Yeah, don't bother.
Couldn't they just renamed it or something, though?
Yeah, well, all they had to do was to rename it. They literally burned all the copies.
That must have been pretty heartbreaking, though, was it?
It certainly was. Yeah, it was a good game as well. So, sort of reawakened the game some years later, 1990, so 8 years later, called Sky Shadow on the Mac, which was basically the same game, but it was 8 years later. It was a very hardcore archaic shoot-em-up, and things moved on, really. So, it was a love it or hate it game, Sky Shadow on the Mac. Some people loved it. But you had to be, had to be the right sort of person to like a game like that. Very, very hardcore, very unforgiving, because it was actually a 1982 arcade game.
I mean, you did do another game for the Apple II, Submarine Commander, with EMI as well, didn't you? How did that deal kind of go down then after you got burnt with Liberator?
Well, no, it was in between, you see. So when they were manufacturing it, I was on my break after university, after first year. They gave me the contract. I paid $5,000 for what was actually only a few weeks' work, really, quite hard work, but over the summer holidays after my first year at uni, to port it from the Atari 400-800. I had to basically write it again from scratch. It was a lot of work, but it was fantastic money. And even then they didn't pay me. Just big company, little guy, but I just made sure I withheld the final bill from them. So they had a buggy version. I wouldn't give them the final bill until they paid me the $5,000, which they then did, of course. but I think it was only after that I found out that actually they destroyed the game I actually wrote. So at least got some money out of them.
You didn't have a very good working relationship with EMI then, it seems.
I didn't really work for them ever again. No, they disappeared anyway. They dabbled in it and then vanished. A lot of the guys there, I think, ended up in Argonaut, actually. No. Josh Ellis actually was there at the same time as me.
How much of a change was it going from the Apple II to the Mac then, in development terms? It must have been.
Oh, massive, really. When the Mac came out, I had my best friend was working for Apple at the time. He'd been headhunted by them. So he was their sales director at Apple UK. So I was able to get very early hardware, prototype hardware. I didn't pay for a computer, actually, until I was probably my 30s. So I got everything supplied. Apple used to supply me with lots of hardware, so quite fun. I had some stuff that Apple IIc I had to keep hidden under the bed as a prototype unit. But back on the original Mac days, you couldn't program on the Mac. You didn't have enough memory. You had to program on Lisa. So you had to cross-compile this gigantic, great Lisa machine to actually write Mac games. My first Mac game, Crystal Rager, was actually written on the Lisa.
I mean, even getting used to, using a GUI, I guess, was a big thing after, coming from the Apple II.
Yeah, and what they actually ended up doing, they retrofitted it into the Apple II. So right at the end of the Apple II, there was some GUI stuff coming in. And I was actually working, did quite a lot of prototype work at the time for Apple on creating a proper GUI for the Apple II based on the Mac. That never saw the light of day, but that was in conjunction with Apple UK. There's the equivalent of QuickDraw, which is the Mac rendering engine, if you like, for the Apple II. So I was actually retrofitting the GUI into the Apple II at the time. I like a lot of that work. It never saw the light of day.
Well, in 1987, you released Crystal Quest as well, and that seemed to be incredibly popular.
That's one that really took off. So that was the Crystal Razor. I wrote Crystal Razor in 2 days. All it really was just to mess around, learn the OS, learn the development system. It's an incredibly simple game. Released it to shareware, they sent me a tenner and sent it out. And that actually did get a lot of people playing it. Unfortunately, people sent me $10, which cost me about £6 to convert a $10 check. And at the time, the exchange rate meant that the $10 check wasn't worth £6, which wasn't great. But one of the guys that did send me a check was Mike Green, the CEO of Paston Green. So when I then wrote Crystal Quest as the follow-up and sent that out, sent a letter out to all the people that had paid me the $10, even though I hadn't got any money from them in reality, one of them was Mike, and he said, whoa, stop, don't send this claim out, I want to publish it. So that's what I did. So I actually refunded, with his help, all the people that sent their $10, even though I hadn't got any money from them. And we published Crystal Quest through Paston Green. It was the first colour game for the Mac. It was also the first game that had any real sort of editor, any sort of modability. You could mod that game. We won a CES Showcase Award for that, actually. It was very, very ahead of its time. The concept of modding in an easy way, plus in a quite advanced way if you wanted to. And you could publish, if you want, mod files for that, which in 1987 was... As I believe, unique.
Yeah, I mean, was that on, like, bulletin boards or public domain libraries, yeah, that kind of thing?
Yeah, and Covermouth, of course, was, then Covermouth floppies, of course, quite a bit then. But yeah, so it's, bulletin board stuff. But I think on the dirt, I can't really remember how it got distributed, that stuff, but it definitely did get around, because that's how the shareware version of Crystal Raider got around, so...
Yeah, it's the thing back then, though, you know, people would just, even like the playground kind of scene, wasn't it, copying discs and that, that grow, you know, pretty exponentially.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, the irony is, Neil Binding, Nobby Binding, who I set up Stainless with, after that in the 90s, we actually got back, we were school friends, but we lost contact for like 10 years. We actually got back in contact because he'd been playing Crystal Quest and ripped off copy of it, playing it for years. His designers or using Macs, and he suddenly notices my name on the boot screen. And hang on, he was my mate from school, wasn't he? And he looked me up in the phone book and gave me a call. So, so we actually got back together, and Stainless wouldn't have happened in a bizarre way if he hadn't have ripped off Crystal Quest.
That's crazy.
You know, just paid
Well, another game that really interests me is Cyber War, which was film The Lawnmower Man.
Don't blame me for that one. That was contract work.
was that one of the last titles you did for the Macintosh?
No, Carmageddon was on the Mac, Carmageddon 1 and 2. But that's the last title I did as a freelancer. So I set up Stainless in 94, but it took us a year to get a contract. So while we're talking to SCI about Carmageddon and Magic Fitting to their sort of release schedule, they said, hey, we can do some contract work. So I did that personally. So that Cyber War was actually the last game I did as a freelancer, outside of Stainless. It was fascinating what they were trying to do with that. That was Fergus McGill and John Chasey, who are the guys behind that. They were trying pre-rendered graphics, were the new thing. So Jane Tanelar filled their office up in Southampton with all these certain graphics workstations, and they were rendering this stuff, so the graphics were well ahead of its time. But it was odd because it took me back to Dragon's Lair, games like that, which ironically enough, I actually had the rights to at one stage, many years ago in the 80s. So the games where they're rendering stuff and you press the button at the right time, it switches to render stream A rather than B, but you don't feel like you're playing the game. So Lawnmower Man and Cyber War looked fantastic, but fortunately, it was a directional game design that soon shriveled.
Was it kind of strange being an Apple dev on the kind of other side of the pond, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I could not get backing for Stainless at all. So when we set Stainless, I talked to everybody from EA, every single company in the UK, all the big publishers, lots of developers as well. And they were saying, well, who the hell are you? You know, we're not going to back you for a project. You've never done anything. And despite the fact that at that time, I'd had 12 years of published games, published experience, but it was much more so then, very, very partisan. Over here, if you're someone like me, should have had a background in the BBC Micro and the Commodore, obviously, all the stuff, all that sort of platform, Specky, obviously. Because I didn't, it meant nothing at all. If I'd been in America, everyone knew who I was. In Britain, no one knew who I was. So it was very, very difficult to actually get back there. It took us a full year to get someone to sign up what became Carmageddon.
I think the first Mac I saw was probably the late 80s in my auntie's print shop, but I didn't see another one until, like, you know, the late 90s. So it's like, you know, they weren't that commonplace outside of, like, kind of niche industries, really, for quite a while, were they, over here?
That's right, yeah, it was print, basically, over here, print. Whereas in the States, very, very different. There's a really big gaming scene in the States. You know, over here, absolutely nothing.
So, you and Neil Barnden decided to team together and form this new company.
Yep.
How was it forming the company, and how was that kind of transition into the 3D world with all the kind of rendered environments and textures and stuff?
Yeah, well, I've been working freelance, so by that time I was 31. I've been working freelance since I was 17. And you sort of feel, well, hang on a minute, you're always waiting for the next contract to come through. What are you going to do? You're not building anything, you're not actually... 3 years later, where are you going to be? Just waiting for the next thing. So I wanted to actually create something and build something, and it was natural to do it with Mill. So, and that was happened to be at the same time as 3D was coming in. So we actually had our own engine at that stage. It took us so long. This guy that had a published game for Casting Ring on the Mac as well. He wrote his own 3D Raven engine. By the time we got the game funded with SCI for the whole year, he got off and got a job somewhere else, and we were left without any engine. But you know, we looked at all the latest stuff, RenderWare at the time, RenderMorphics became DirectNets, and Render, or B-Render, which is the Argonaut system. So I've got a very solid maths background, maths physics background anyway, so I didn't find it particularly difficult to move into that.
And I mean, at that stage, you couldn't really get away with releasing 2D games around the mid-90s, could you? Everything had to be 3D all of a sudden.
No, we couldn't. We did this demo using our own engine in 94, early 94, actually. One of the first people... Well, that came about actually from talking to Carl Jeffries, who owns Climax, who was just over the water from us. I went over there and chatted to him. It was really helpful. He said, yeah, hopefully, I'm going to set up a company and stuff. And he said, mate, what you've just got to go and do a demo. Go and do a demo, and then you might get it somewhere. Otherwise, you're just talking hot air. So we did this demo, which was really ahead of its time. This 3D Destruction Derby, we called it, demo. Using 3D, using proper physics, proper car physics, and proper just damage physics as well. We showed that around to people, and the demo, because it was 3D and proper physics that early, got a lot of people taking notice of us. But as I said, it was as they saw it, the lack of any sort of experience and heritage that really made it difficult to get signed up, despite the fact that what we were doing was you know, ahead of the curve.
So how did this kind of 3D Destruction Derby title turn into Carmageddon with all the sick machines and the really cool little video in the corner and everything?
Yeah, the video in the corner was there on the original demo. So my hobby at the time was banner racing, so every other Sunday during the summer I smashed up cars for fun and Whiplash for the rest of the week. Got Nobby into it a bit as well, so he raced a few times, and not quite as obsessively as me. But it sort of came about from me always turning around in racing games, get bored by racing games, whether it was Ridge Racer or Daytona or whatever, and trying my hardest to hit the cars coming the other way. And then thinking, why don't we make a game out of this? Why don't we make a game where the idea is to hit the cars coming the other way? So the game came about from those two things. A, it was my hobby anyway, for real. And B, it was that, let's make a game where you're meant to disrupt the race. You're meant to do the thing you're not meant to do, if you like.
And having that driver's face is such a good kind of reaction to see when the driver's hitting something. It's, you know.
Yeah, the frat can, that was great fun. We've got footage, raw footage somewhere of the actual footage of doing that, where we're actually hitting Tony, who's the nutter. we're smacking him around the head, the back of the head with a pull cue to get the whiplash effect. He was going, go on, hit me harder. There's video footage of this. This is on YouTube. If you look it up somewhere, there's footage of him going through the windscreen and my big old Yank had a Chevy Caprice. We went out to get some footage for reference. So what does it look like? The artist wanted to see, what does it look like when you run someone over? So we went out to the local car park opposite the office and repeatedly ran him over. and he actually went to the windscreen at one stage. And that is on video. It's on the internet out there somewhere.
We'll put it in our show notes.
Someone called the police eventually and said there's someone being run over in the car park. They came to check us out. So.
Yeah, but that took some explaining, did it?
It did, yeah. But the video camera on the tripod, the guy sort of stood there going, I don't mind, yeah. Go on, hit me harder. Yeah, it became Carmageddon because SEI were very much a licensed-based publisher, obviously. Hence, Lawn Mower Man and all those games that you previously. They were very much around licenses. So they said, yeah, this is great, we'll do it. And they actually took a punch on us, which was very appreciated and still is to this day, because no one else would trust us. So they said, yeah, they will do it, we'll fund it. But they originally put Mad Max license on it, so the game was actually going to be a Mad Max license.
Oh, wow.
They couldn't find the rights holders, though, back then. Couldn't find who owned it. It was very vague what the ownership was. So they gave up on that. It was then Death Race, because there was going to be a new Death Race film called Death Race 2020. And the Etsy of Carmageddon was called Death Race without an A, because it had the eight characters, right until we shipped it. It was still called Death Race .etsy. So the running people over on it got put in there because it was going to be Death Race. That was why that ended up got put in there. That was purely because of the license. And then reasonably early in development, they couldn't get that. Then the film wasn't happening. Roger Corman, I don't know what happened, but the film never happened anyway, so the license never happened. And SEI went, right, sorry, let's just do it anyway. We won't license it. The game looks like it can stand up on its own, or rather be run over on its own, I guess. So that's what happened. They went, yeah, okay, that's more things for the name, which Robbie came up with the Carmageddon name. So that's just sort of where it came from. But I think the fact that running people over wasn't originally part of the game is why it's a good game as well, because there was a core game in there all along. Some people, we were often accused, and still are, of only getting sales because of the controversy value of it. And our argument to that is, well, actually, they weren't even in there in the first place. And there was long in there a switch in the code where you could either lose points or gain points for hitting them. We still weren't sure right up until the end whether we could even get away with it. It was actually an avoiding game at one stage.
You decided to go to the BBFC to get a game rating. Voluntary, exactly. Wasn't it?
It was complicated. It was voluntary, but I think, obviously, this is more SCI than us. We were exposed to it all very much, but SCI were the ones who did it directly. It looked like it was going to have trouble, so they thought, OK, best bet is to get it rated. That way we'll avoid the trouble because it will have a rating. And it backfired on them because they refused to rate it and they banned it. So it was the only game ever to be banned. It was the first product we banned, I think, since Driller Killer, the infamous video that actually coined the term video nasty.
Yeah. It sent the coolness ratings for me and my mates through the roof when that got banned.
It's quite scary at the time that the office got raided at SCI. We were never raided, but we were everybody. Us doing this was told, don't answer the phone if the press call, if they call around your house and all that sort of thing, just refer them to SCI. We didn't really get too much of that.
Oh, wow.
It got quite nasty, all good publicity, but I think for SCI as well, it's very, very stressful because they were personally liable for this. So it was more stressful for them than us, actually. We thought it was hilarious.
Well, I mean, the game did get banned in some countries outright, didn't it? And I know it was censored in Germany and the UK. I mean, did you have to make changes originally?
Yeah, it was censored in the UK. We did various things. There was a disc that you could put in the drive when you played the game, and it would then crack it, basically. And we obviously denied all knowledge. No idea how that disc ever got out there that would give it red blood. So we had to put the green blood in here last minute. But when they overturned the BBFC's rating, then the red blood was then switched back on, sort of permanently. It was banned in Germany, but everything's banned in Germany, so it still is. We were banned in France, we were banned in Australia. Australia's looking very strict. The funniest one was Brazil. We were banned at the end of the week. So at the start of the week, they said, this game is going to be banned at the end of the week. So, of course, our sales are fantastic that week. So you want to go out and buy it.
Rush out and get it while you can, yeah.
W.H. Smith banned the demo disc for the cover mail. I can't remember what magazine it was. It might be PC Zone. And they said, we're not carrying that. There's no way we're not going to carry that. Until it went to number one. So when it came out, it was new entry at number one on the All Formats chart. And W.H. Smith immediately went, OK, maybe we will carry it then. So as soon as they realised they were losing sales of magazines, they started carrying it.
Well, how well received were the console ports?
The original... See, our original contract with SCI was to do PC, PlayStation and Saturn. Mm. It soon became clear that Saturn was their point. The PlayStation, though, we ended up subcontracting that. That was a basket child of a game, really, because it went through, I think, at least four developers, each one failing. So we just couldn't get it done at the same time. There were only eight of us at the same time as PC. So they subcontracted it. I can't remember where now. But they then subcontracted it again after taking that company to court. They then subcontracted it again. Every time it failed because the PlayStation hardware just wasn't up to it. And they eventually took it internally to their studio, and they did actually a really good job of it. People like John Corr, Steve Haggerty, who's still on the island, I know very well still, did a great job on porting eventually a job that three companies couldn't do. But the hardware really wasn't up to the physics, so it was never the game it should have been. The Nintendo 64 version is known as one of the worst games ever made. Because again, the hardware just couldn't do it. It just couldn't do it at all. But SCI wanted to get out on lots of platforms, so they put it out anyway. But the eventual PlayStation version was quite a reasonable game in the end, but had such a difficult birth.
Even space limitations on the N64 cartridges, I bet, made it difficult.
Oh, it's impossible. They should never have done it. It shouldn't have been done. It was really silly. They should have just done a technical evaluation and gone, this is not going to work, and not done it.
Well, the Splat Pack came out in 1997. Did that add anything?
A little bit. So we had to pause development of Carmageddon 2 because the Carmageddon 1 just sold so well. They said, OK, we'll delay Carmageddon 2 by 3 months and quickly put out what you'd now call DLC. We had a few rendering features. It had transparency in it, which we didn't have on Carmageddon 1. And it had support for hardware graphics, because Carmageddon 1 was all software rendering. That's what it was at the time. And just when we came out, hardware graphics cards like 3DFX were just starting to come out. So Splat Pack added support for hardware graphics and for transparency. So you have things like glass and things like that. But no other actual features.
Well, let's talk about the second game then. What were kind of the aims of Carmageddon 2 Carpocalypse now then? What did you want to add to that game and improve on the original?
Basically, everything we not managed to fit into the first one. But right, let's do it now, which isn't really the best approach to game design. so we tried to do everything, and we did. We did actually ship that game on time. The fact it was delivered to Gold Master 2 weeks ahead of time to SCI on that. But that's the hardest I've ever worked. I had young kids at the time, and I didn't see them for like 4 or 5 months at the end of that game. We were all working till gone dawn, so we were going home at like 8, 9 a.m. And we said never again after that. So that game was designed basically by let's do everything we possibly can. And the hours were just ridiculous, even by video game development standards. Those hours were crazy. And you could argue that the game wasn't as pure as Karma 1. It had some great things, technically fantastic things in it. But I think in a way, Carmageddon 1 was a purer, more visceral experience in certain ways. So
I often read that people often regard the first game as more fun.
Yeah, I think so. So we're really layering in the features on the second one without maybe taking enough of a step backwards.
I mean, is that why you decided to make it a PC exclusive then, just because it was so technically advanced?
I was saying there's no way it was on a console. Yeah. Both games on the Mac, though, as well. As I said, they're actually developed almost entirely on the Mac, Karma 1 and Karma 2. They're actually ported to PC. The reason being the development environment was so much better on the Mac. The debugger on Code Warrior was so much better than the PC debugger. So we'd actually develop the game on the Mac and really just do a PC build just to ship it. So there were Mac versions of it as well, but yeah, there's no consoles came to hand in that at all.
So what happened with the third game then? Because I read that you weren't involved in TDR 2000.
Oh, well, I'm a bitter story from the video games industry. So they, Nobby and I went up for a meeting at SCI after Carmageddon shipped, and they went, right, off we go then, let's do Carmageddon 3. We went, whoa, hang on. So we just come off this crazy, I don't know how many hours a week, 80 to 100, it really was, 7 days a week. Yeah, grab a few hours sleep. It's like Apollo program level of working.
Yeah.
We were, so we went, no, hang on, we're just going straight off it. And creatively, we'd rather do something else. Don't want to go straight into the third one, having done nothing but Carmageddon for, by that time, basically 4 years, doing the demo. And then, oh, okay, fair enough. 3 or 4 months later, we read in CTW, the trade press, that Carmageddon 3 was coming out, written by tourists in Australia. That's the first thing we knew about it, was reading it in the press. What they never said to us was, are you sure you don't want to do it? Because otherwise we'll give it to someone else. So then we were going, oh, okay, then, yeah, maybe we will. But no, they took we want to do something else as a blanket refusal. So that hurt. Yeah, that was, and it was a rubbish game. There's a few strange people out there that like it, but by and large, we distance ourselves very much from it.
Well, I was going to say, it got some dreadful reviews, didn't it?
It's awful. It's just because you needed the original developers. A game like Carmageddon, it's all about the twisted brains of myself and Nobby. And you try and get someone else to interpret it. As SCI kept doing for many years afterwards. Well, you can't. You know, certain games. It's like, imagine someone else did Half Life rather than Valve.
Yeah,
it just wouldn't work. Yeah, you can't. It doesn't work sometimes. When a game is a proper representation of its creators, in the same as a film. It's no different if you look at later Terminators or Robocops or whatever. You know, it needs the original creator involved to make a creative product properly valid. If somebody else tries to take it over, it's usually a pale shadow. So TDR 2000 is just one example of a huge list of things like that.
Well, I mean, Carmageddon, first two games had had your sense of humour in there and your personalities in the game as well, which we're all missing in the third one.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, talking of a game with a good sense of humour, State of Emergency is a fantastic little title. I really love that. Were you reading lots of Judge Dredd and stuff at the time?
Mitch was developing that for years. It was a game that it started out as a riot simulator, a much more sort of top-down simulation game designed by Kirk Ewing. And the game was really going nowhere. The game didn't know what it was, if you like. So I was parachuted in as executive director on that with complete freedom to redesign, change the team around, do whatever I want, and basically get the game turned around and shipping. So I just took a look at the whole thing, wrote up what worked, what didn't work, everywhere, anything that didn't work, a reason to make it work. But we only had 6 months, really, to always start from scratch. So within that remit, it was a good game.
It was a great budget title as well. It was really...
Yeah, that's what it was in the end. Because it was, even though it had been going for years, almost everything was thrown away. So it was, from me coming into shipping, it was probably about 9 months. It was almost starting from scratch in that. So there are so many design decisions that basically had to go, no, that's not going to fit. It's not going to ship. It had already been so late. But it was number one both sides of the Atlantic. But it was a fun little game.
Well, speaking of more, scale-back titles that weren't maybe as technically advanced, you actually had a project of bringing back some classic Atari titles to Xbox Live Arcade.
Yes, that was a joy for me because I played all those games at university, and my background as a hobbyist was hardware anyway. I played with hardware since I was 12, 13. The only reason I really got into programming properly was I couldn't afford to buy chips, buy the hardware or pocket money. So being able to then take the circuit diagrams of games that I adored as a teenager and to create a proper emulation of those was a dream come true for me. That's fantastic work. I enjoy that so much.
Well, how did you go about converting those, you know, old games that were made for like a single button joystick, most of them, for or trackballs, you know, to the Xbox hardware and controller?
All but two of them were truly emulated. So they were actually were running the ROMs and were running the hardware. And what I then did is look through all the assembler of them. Fortunately, it's 6502, which is what I use for the Apple II, so I can think 6502. Worked out how they were working and got hooks in there to make basically the Xbox then do completely different things and raise the achievements and change the graphics of them. But even the really updated versions of those games were still running the original code. Because I was hooking in and sort of watching what it was doing and reacting to it. So it was quite an odd way of doing things. We didn't do that with the Battlezone Warlords and Missile Command Evolved. We didn't do that with. We thought, no, we need to. It would restrict us a bit too much. The Warlords and Battlezone, they had to be multiplayer. So the Evolved versions of those were written from scratch.
Did you manage to meet or collaborate with any of the original designers?
Barely. I got a very quick email exchange of Al Alcorn, who wrote Asteroids, who is now doing something or other. I can't remember what it was, but he didn't seem that interested, actually, and they've moved on. And all the rest of them, Atari had no idea how to contact anyone where they were. So it was only Al Alcorn, and which I thought was going to be great, but nothing.
I guess Atari had been through about four different companies by that stage, I guess.
Oh, exactly, yeah. Yeah. So they didn't have a clue who did what. So Centipede was the first commercial game written by a woman, actually. Well, so Centipede and Millipede. Yeah, I can't remember her name. But, yeah, that was the first one. But I know these were back when, you know, like when my first game was a one-person game. So, yeah, they lost all those contacts. But it was great doing it.
Well, throughout this whole time, there was still a huge Carmageddon fan community, and they were still alive.
So, yeah, they were alive, yeah.
So you decided to do a remake. How hard was it to get the rights back for Carmageddon?
It was probably years. I mean, there were 200 fan sites out there for Carmageddon. But even when it got to the early 2010s, there were still loads of fan sites out there. There were still people modifying the game, even then, like 15 years later. We talked to SCI quite a lot about doing more work. We were about to do another version of Carmageddon with them when they reversed into IDOS and suddenly had far bigger fish to fry. So all of a sudden they owned Tomb Raider. So that all just sort of fizzled. So nothing was really going to happen with it, but they were never going to sell us the rights. Then when Square Enix bought IDOS, you know, which were then SCI, We asked them really just for the, you know, well, why not? You might as well ask, assuming that they would never want to sell. And they're very surprisingly, they were willing to sell it. They just bought this company, had all these sort of, you know, IP in the vault. It was never something that Square Enix were ever going to use. But it still surprised us that they sold us the rights. Very much so, we've been trying for so many years, and we thought, well, it's really gone now. Now Square have got it. It was quite the opposite. They were brilliant. We got it lock, stock, and barrel. Ironically enough, we own TGR 2000 as well. It's all of Carmageddon. So even the game that, not sure how much I can swear on this podcast. But anyway, those charming people did. We ended up owning that even.
There's no plans to remake that though, no?
No. Well, if you think about remaking it and then not releasing it to anyone, burning every copy of it.
Well, I mean, what was kind of the, you know, when you announced that you're going to be doing like an updated version of Carmageddon, what was the reaction like then?
No, the reaction was really good. A lot of people still love the game, so they're really pleased to see it back. Obviously, the Kickstarter campaign, we just hit the Kickstarter downward curve, so we still, you know, we made our target, made good money on that. Tiny fraction of the development budget, as we said, really, yeah, 10%, probably less, the development budget. But it was great. What it did do is it showed that how many people liked the idea of it coming back. It's all very well and good people saying they liked it and saying they liked the idea of it coming back. putting their money where their mouth is on a Kickstarter campaign is different. That means that they really do want it. So the Kickstarter campaign was something that validated that fact that people did want it.
So it took 2 years to go from beta to full release, and I remember seeing different reviews of it at different points in the beta. And then later on, an update came out, and then I started seeing crazy good reviews for it. So,
we really learned the hard way what it is to try and self-publish with that. We had no support on that. We did it entirely ourselves. So we were pressurized. Obviously, we had investors that had put money into it on the back of, as I said, the Kickstarter stuff. So you're pressurizing to release it, and we haven't got the funds. Do a Valve or a Gig or all those companies that can just go, yeah, we'll release it when it's ready. Or we can't do that because we've got people clamouring after getting their money back. So you end up with a gun to your head and being forced to release it too early. And that's what we've had to do. So it got a bad backlash because it was buggy, and in particular the frame rate was bad because it's all our own engine. Every single part of that code there is all our own. So it did take a long time to then keep on working at it, really self-funded. There's a lot of money went into that. All our royalties from doing all the Magic the Gathering work that we did for Wizards, that sold well, and Wizards of the Coast is a really good company to work for. So we've got good royalties for that. And I've still got a gigantic mortgage. Because rather than take the royalties out, we ploughed it all into Carmageddon to keep it, to get it out there.
Well,
good game in the end.
Well, that's the thing. A lot of these games, they'll initially release, and then people will go, "Oh, that's not amazingly good," and then they'll disappear into obscurity. The thing is, you updated, and everyone turned around and then said, yeah, "Take a relook at this. This is a fantastic remake." So.
Yeah, we believed in it. I think it's a Carmageddon Reincarnation and Carmageddon Max Damage, which was the PC version of the console version, so a lot of stuff added. It's a very, very good game. So we believed in the game. We believed it's a really good game. The problem we had with it, though, was exposure to it. We have no marketing budget. And I still meet people to this day that say, "Oh, Carmageddon, I love that," and have no idea there's a new version of it out there.
I know with Max Damage, I saw, there were some reviews in, the Metro and the Mirror that weren't very flattering to it. But I think, do you think that was a case of, the mainstream gaming press today struggling to understand it a bit? Because, I know the fans loved it, but they were saying it felt retro, which I imagine was probably part of the appeal, to original fans.
It was, yeah. I mean, particularly the console version. See, that goes back to something we talked about much earlier, is that we felt that now the consoles had finally caught up. With Carmageddon, the consoles could now do the things you needed to do in Carmageddon. We were wrong, because it was incredibly difficult to get a PS4 and an Xbox to work with that, the code that worked on a PC. It was really, really difficult, actually, but we did manage it. So it was, Carmageddon always felt to us like it was a console game. It's a very arcadey, fun, bright, exciting sort of game. It always felt that console was its natural home. So we felt this new version, it was like it come full circle. Finally, it could be on its, into its natural home. But it was a retro title. Things, again, have moved on a little bit. Not dissimilar to what I said earlier about Sky Shadow, my original Apple II 1982 hardcore shoot-em-up, not being right for 1990 on the Mac. A very free-form 1997 game coming out now on consoles is something that's some of the problem because we didn't know what to do with it. But the fun of Carmageddon, as I'm sure you know, is that you can do what you want. Off you go. Just have fun. You don't need to do what the game isn't telling you what to do. You can go and do what you want. Play it how you want. And that isn't trending. Now, games more and more hold your hand all the way through. So I think some of the More contemporary reviewers now, they didn't get it. They didn't get what is the freedom of this game. If you don't understand that, you can get lost very quickly as to what the game's all about, and you can very quickly dislike it.
Well, I've heard And I've actually seen pictures of you having a bigger Carmageddon car yourself. And I was wondering if you drive around the Isle of Wight scaring people with it.
We have actually got that, yeah. The rat rod. Well, we've had a few actually, but yeah, the rat rod. Which I've built a mistake. That is actually in a lockup over here, actually. It's in Cowes. So it wouldn't be very road legal, but we drove it from LA, actually. So my wife had to drive it from LA. It was a day after we landed, so we were really jet lagged. Picked it up from the hot rod shop in LA. She'd only driven in mistakes a couple of times on the wrong side of the road. She had to drive this thing because she was the only one small enough to fit in it, right through downtown LA traffic with no brakes. The blade sticking out of it. So with me behind her in a hire car and Jason Garber, our publishing director, in front of her. So we've got guarding her either side. So that has been driven through public roads right through downtown LA, I think.
I bet it's a good way to get through traffic jams.
Yeah, it's got a lot of people looking, I'm
telling you. Well, do you consider bringing back any other IPs, like older ones, do you know? Liberator or anything like that.
Crystal Quest, funny enough, only this week I renewed a trademark on Crystal Quest. I own Crystal Quest personally, so I licensed that. Yeah, Tuesday. I kept hold of that myself. I renewed it for another 10 years. I'd love to. I think there's still a lot of there's a lot of love for that game. So many people really, really love Crystal Quest. It was ubiquitous. Most people copied it. You didn't pay for it. But it was on every Macintosh for about 4 years. Mm. So I'd love to do something particular Crystal Quest and do something. There's still scope for that, for doing something with it. And for Carmageddon, we released Carmageddon Crashers, a free to play game on Android and iOS recently. So yeah, we're still working with Carmageddon. There's something else we're doing. Well, we're prototyping for Carmageddon. So Carmageddon, we'll still be doing things with. Moving into future. I think Crystal Quest has still got legs in it.
I thought Carmageddon VR, where you have to dodge cars coming at you. That could be interesting.
That would be good. Yeah, that would be an underwear changer.
Well, Patrick, if people want to keep up to date with you, where can they find you? Got a website, social media, do you do all that?
I know, if I started doing Twitter, I'd never put my phone down. That's the trouble. So.
We know the feeling.
I'm purposely avoiding Twitter. I mean, StainlessGames.com, Carmageddon.com, show what we're doing, basically, so it's all up there.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for coming on this week, Patrick. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. It's been an honour.